Namaste. So we enter into chapter 20, which is equality and knowledge. The Gita and Sri Aurobindo in his yoga, they stress on equality as the foundation. So it is the foundation for both works and knowledge. So works, as we know, in the Gita, in the context of the Gita, the time of the Gita, when Sri Krishna uses the word yoga, he is not referring to Patanjali's yoga. Patanjali is not in the picture. He is referring to Karma Yoga. That's what we have seen. Whenever he uses the word yoga, so he is referring to Karma Yoga. When he says yoga, karma, shukasalam, he is referring to Karma Yoga. And he is expounding what Karma Yoga is. So why I am saying this? Because nowadays, either we talk about Raj Yoga or Hatha Yoga or Patanjali Yoga when we talk of yoga. But in the Gita, yoga means karma, through the path of karma, not synonymous with karma. How through the path of karma we can arrive at yoga? And for that, equality is important. Because if we don't have equality, it is basic common sense, then if we have preferences for some works and not for other works, then we cannot discover the divine presence which is in all. He's, as we were reading the other day, in the shock of the star and in the grain of sand, Samam Brahmam, he is equally present. So the moment we begin to make preferences, and that's why very often in yoga practices, a basic training which is given to people is in this spirit of equality. And that's why when people went to mother, the mother would give them a work. And sometimes they would feel, this is not a work suited to my, whatever they thought, temperament or capacity, what I have been trained in. Lot of people do this, they write, they say, I want to come to the ashram and teach in the school. So, because they are teachers outside, and you have to tell them, you have to become a student who has no idea about knowledge, and you have to grow first in knowledge, then teaching is a different matter altogether. Whatever work the mother gives, that is yoga. So if we don't have the equality, we will constantly be struggling within that this is not the work that I am meant to do. And then we not only not enjoy the work and the whole process of growth, we are not able to discover the divine in all, which is an important, without which we cannot undertake the work. Now the moment we say that discovering the divine in all, there is a problem. The problem is, are we supposed to treat everyone with an equal mind, equal soul? The Gita says, yes, you have to be equal soul. Then how do I act at all? If I see the pandit and the cow and the elephant and the gold and the, the dust and the clay, sama lost kanchana, pandit gava hastini, that's how the Gita puts it. So how do we act? Does it mean somebody gives gold to me and I just value it like dust and throw it anywhere? What does it mean? Because how do I act in the world? So this is to act in the world, we need knowledge. We can't act without that. Otherwise, we'll just become a witness. So therein we see the significance of equality vis-a-vis knowledge. So equality for works is important, but how to act in the world, which is full of varieties, variations, we need knowledge. How does equality lead to knowledge? Again, we see that because what we call as knowledge are all our opinions, informations, ideas picked up from here, there, everywhere. So nowadays, there is a trend. Some people ask, they say, okay, so you mean that by freedom, it means non-conformity to anything. So I said, it means non-conformity means attachment to non-conformity. You have to be free from all these ideas which are circulating around. Because knowledge starts with humility. So when the mind is free of all these conceptions, all, including our highest conceptions, God is this, God is that, all these conceptions, then an inner door opens by the divine grace. It cannot open by effort, and knowledge begins to pour in. And this knowledge is very different from intellectual knowledge and WhatsApp knowledge and informational knowledge and reading of books, because it is always fresh. It is not like today we read a book and then forever we say, no, this is written in the book. But the Gita liberates us from being the people of the book, if you want to put it. We are not people of a book, we are people of God. That's how Sri Aurobindo says, we are not the sadhaka of a book or many books, but the sadhaka of the infinite. That's why the Gita reminds us, and Sri Aurobindo reminds us, sabda brahmati vartate. So the scripture is helpful, but it itself can bound us. The scripture is helpful because when we practice it, it can lead us to that state of utter freedom where no scripture is needed. When whatever one does, whichever way one does, wherever one is, it's a God-driven action. Some people say, oh, whatever one does, yes, but you will be driven by the divine will. You don't have to worry, because again the mental yardstick, oh, then you can do anything. No, you can't do anything. You will do what God demands of you, which to the outer eyes may look morally correct, wrong, whatever our assessment may be. Arjuna has been asked to do this ghoram karma. Or it may look very different from the human assessment. It's a God-driven action based on God knowledge. And this knowledge, as the Gita puts it, burns away all karma. So how does it burn away all karma? The Gita in fact describes in the image of the Veda that they are like waters. We remember the story of Hercules. Hercules is asked to clean the Aegean stables. So Aegean stable has 1,000 horses. One of the 7 difficult tasks for Hercules. So how do you clean a stable? By the time you read the 1,000th horse, or much before that, the first horse has started dirtying it again. So what does Hercules do? He sees a nearby stream and builds a canal from the stream to this place with a kind of a entry-closing mechanism. So when what he does is he doesn't clean one by one. When this time, he just opens the door and that water comes, rushes and cleans the whole stable. It's a very well-known phrase. Cleaning the Aegean stables is a near impossible task. So what happens to the God lover, God seeker, who is practicing sincerely Karma Yoga, as expounded in the Gita and on the basis of foundation of equality, that the works are, the person no more feels claim to that work. He is no more the claimant to a throne or to a position or to anything. He is there acting because God has so appointed him, and he will be equally fine if tomorrow he goes away from there, because he is not working for himself but for God. So then what happens? One is free from the sense of the doer. So that knowledge not only purifies, it burns away karma, because there is no karma. So the state of the person who has found God, if you ask him, oh, what are you doing, this, that, say, I'm doing nothing. Actually, it's a true state. It's not something which is intellectually conceived and spoken. You can't do it intellectually, because then something is there always. No, I'm doing it. It's completely free from the sense of doership. So when you are not a doer, then the bond of karma does not stick to you. That's why we see in the Isha Upanishad, or the consequences of karma are no more yours. When divine is doing it, he takes the consequences, whatever be the consequences. And that's what we see always, and that's the great teaching in the Isha Upanishad. It is spoken like this, kurvanneveh karmani jijivishashatangsama. Doing verily works in the world, we should live for 100 years. And then he says, thus the karma will not cleave to you. But the basis of doing this action is in the previous phrase. Ishavasya midam sarvam yat kinche jagatyam jagat. So when we do action completely dedicating it to God, all actions, and this dedication is not an outer thing that I close my eyes, we close our eyes and say a mantra. It is an inner, sometimes people expect that. Someone once told me in one of the talks, sir, everything is fine, wonderful, but it will be so nice if you start your talk with Hari Om. So I said, excuse me, the day I start doing it. It's not to effect. It's not that one closes the eyes and sits in meditation and does something and takes a mantra. You may do all this mechanically, It that inner state that this action is yours, mother. Take it. And the proof is equality. If we have really done it, the proof will be equality. We will not be nobody, you know, if we get praise, if we get insult, if we get criticism, that is not going to affect us because we are in that state of equanimity. And that's how desireless action proceeds. And when desires are gone and the karma continues, it does not mean abandoning karma. It means now we are no more doing karma impelled by desire. No more doing karma based on my likes and dislikes, because I'm in a state of equanimity. So this is the second thing that the Gita teaches us, that we are freed from the sting of karma. And we wake up to knowledge. Now this knowledge, obviously, as we have seen earlier, is not informational knowledge. So what kind of knowledge this is? This knowledge is that intuitive knowledge where whatever is required to be done, how to do it, when to do it, why to do it, all that comes in a flash and one does it. It's not based on any book reading or you know, scriptural understanding. So does it mean that philosophical knowledge, scientific knowledge are meaningless? No, they can be also meaningful. How they can be meaningful? In scientific knowledge, through scientific knowledge, we can discover the ways of God's working in creation. So scientific knowledge will not stop with discovery of some forces, but will take us to the ultimate, the way divine works. For example, in the field of medicine, certain things are helping us, certain things are not helping us get cured. So one will begin to see that through nature, divine has so worked out this creation that there are certain things which contain dravya guna, aushadhi guna. They contain, that's who has put it, divine has put it through nature. Similarly, certain things are harmful. Very often the two are together. The same thing which can be poisonous, the same remedy also carries a cure. Now all this one begins to discover. That's how homeopathy was discovered, like almost in a mystic way. Shubhinda one says that I am wondering whether Hanuman was a mystic. This does not mean that anybody practicing homeopathy is a mystic. It's the same problem, that one becomes the slave of a book. One has to be a mystic and then practice. That's a different thing altogether. Similarly, there are other lines through which nature heals, as we see that allopaths have discovered in the body. So even the cells themselves have the healing capacity. So one discovered that the divine has so built, created this world through nature, that there are several lines through which healing takes place. I'm just taking one example of healing. Faith heals. So we can, once we understand, then all this can come very handy. So in God's action or work in the world, this world knowledge is important, the play of world forces. So we can take up scientific knowledge, enter into the play of God. Similarly, philosophical knowledge. It's not philosophical knowledge, it's like, you know, this world is all transient, unhappy. That's not what it means. It means something much deeper. It means when we say world is transient, we need to understand what is happening. For instance, change is the only law of life, yes. But this change has a driving engine behind it, which is God's will. This change has a goal, a purpose. That change is happening, anybody can say. It doesn't require much of. So this is how Sri Aurobindo goes on revealing these truths to us. And in the end, so then, what will be that knowledge based on which we will act? It will not be just indifference, equally. Equality doesn't mean that everybody I will treat with the same soft hand or iron hand, whatever way we put it. That's like death. Death says all are equal to my eyes. That's a flattening of death. But this is a different kind of knowledge. It's not based on that kind of a approach. It's based on to each one the divine gives according to a deeper law, a deeper need which we don't know. That's why we don't understand the cosmic play. Because we expect the divine to treat everybody equal as we conceive. He treats it with equality, but we don't understand his action. And when we try to correct, we create more mess. So we see, for example, communism tries to correct it. Socialism tries to correct it. But you cannot, because the divine has created, there is a reason why things are the way they are. If God wanted, everybody should be equal, with equal money, equal knowledge, equal this thing, then he could have made it, that world. But he has not made it like that. Now we are not talking of what is the secret. Let that secret be for another time. But there is a reason why the world is the way it is. First we should understand it. Then we can act to change. But before we act to change, we must understand the play. Otherwise we will make it more miserable, as we see is happening today, and create more confusion. This is the background of this chapter, Equality and Knowledge. And then we read some very, very beautiful lines. It's chapter 20. Page 200. So he says, knowledge and works are like two wings that assist the flight, or like the two eyes through which you see. As the work grows more and more desireless, equal-minded, sacrificial in spirit, the knowledge increases, and the knowledge increases. With the increase of the knowledge, the soul becomes firmer in the desireless, sacrificial equality of its works. So how does knowledge come in yoga? If not through reading books. Reading books are okay. By the practice of yoga. Yoga knowledge, spiritual knowledge cannot come just by reading a book. So, but when we practice the yoga, then the knowledge flames up from within. What is the practice, he's saying? Equality, desirelessness, renunciation of doership, renunciation of fruits of action. If we do that, then knowledge will begin to come. As knowledge comes, automatically we grow in equality and desirelessness, because then we become aware that why this is a practice which is enjoined upon us. We begin to become aware when we are deviating from equality. So all this is a constantly ongoing process. The sacrifice of knowledge, says the Gita, therefore, is greater than any material sacrifice. Because as this knowledge goes and as we translate it into works, the more knowledge will increase. So we should not be content with any... That's what it means by the ultimate liberation from all systems. Because every time knowledge leaps up, it tries to build a system. Like we see people, mother would say this, mother would do this. So we don't know. Mother is infinite. She can act in one way, another way, million ways, in ways that nobody has ever experienced, known. We don't know. With each one, she is different. So, but when we fix knowledge into a system, then there is a problem. So that's what he says, sacrifice of knowledge. Even if thou art the greatest doer of sin beyond all sinners, thou shalt cross over all the crookedness of evil in the ship of knowledge. There is nothing in the world equal in purity to knowledge. So that's why the ship of knowledge, Sri Aurobindo describes from Sanat Sujati, also speaks of it. The four aids are from that scripture. And there Sri Aurobindo gives a very beautiful image. You say you have to cross over the ocean of ignorance. This world is like a bhavasagar. It's an ocean full of all kinds of things. Good, bad, frightening, charming. So what should be the nature of the ship that will carry you across? So Sri Aurobindo says, Brahma Vidya is the ship. The true knowledge. That is the ship. And it's even practically in life, we need to, even at the most outer level, we need to have knowledge. Otherwise, we may be harmed. So that knowledge is Brahma Vidya. And which will help us cross the Bhavasagar, the ocean of life, full of all kinds of challenges. And then the compass is faith. Faith is the sure compass. So if faith is dimmed, that means perhaps I am going in a wrong direction. Faith is the compass, he says. And then what is the power which is powering the ship and which is carrying it across? He says that power is Shakti, the divine Shakti, the divine mother's force. That is driving the ship. So faith is the compass, the power is Shakti, and the ship is Brahma Vidya. So they who have it will cross, regardless of anything. By knowledge, desire and its firstborn child, sin, are destroyed. So sin is not about the action. Sin is about the motive, the inner state. So when Arjun is asked to kill, it is not a sin. The motive is simply fulfilling God's will. That's for him, that's the only motive. But it doesn't mean that somebody else who starts killing based on the Gita is free from that. No, because he is doing it probably from a selfish motive, for some gain or some desire. So this is how he, the liberated man, is able to do works as a sacrifice, because he is freed from attachment through his mind, heart and spirit being firmly founded in self-knowledge. So this is the basis. And what is the, how this yoga is done? The yoga, next page, page 201. Before that, there is a beautiful line on top, page 201. As a fire kindled turns to ashes its fuel, so the fire of knowledge turns all works to ashes. And of course, he clarifies working, turning all works to ashes does not mean you don't do any action. But all consequences, all its repercussions are gone. Because now it's no more you. It's the divine who is doing it. But there are people who have theories, I've heard, that, you know, Shri Krishna and Arjun, they are both gone to hell, some seventh hell. I heard this fantastic story from some moralist who belonged to a certain religion. I am not going to name the religion. But he said, no, they did something sinful, so they are in hell. I said, maybe your part that they are in hell may be true, but not for the reason you allude to it. They said, why? What do you mean? I said, see, who can go to hell? Who is always full of delight? So Krishna and Arjuna may well be in hell because they want to transform hell, not because of any sins. So here it is that, you know, it's all burnt away by knowledge. The yoga of works is, few lines below, we have seen the offering of all action to the Lord, which induces as its culmination an inner and not an outer, a spiritual, not a physical giving up of works into the Brahman. So it's so simple, this yoga is, if you really look at it, we have to just keep on offering to the mother, sincere offering. And the sign of that sincere offering will be that the works are no more us, the results, the fruits are no more ours. And that's an inner test, because nobody may know outside. And then when we proceed like that, knowledge will flame up from inside. It's like a fire which will automatically spring and grow as we keep on offering the works. And as the fire grows, it burns away all karma, ego, desires, everything, and with it suffering. So that's how one grows in equality. So, page 203. So, what is the sign that we have grown in equality? Very interesting. Third line from above. The Lord in our hearts is in the ignorance also the cause of our actions, but through his maya. It's like we are far away from the sun and there are several layers in between. Yet it is the sun which is working upon us. It's the rays coming filtered. Through the egoism of our lower nature, which creates the tangled web of our actions and brings back upon our egoism the recoil of their tangled reactions, affecting us inwardly as sin and virtue, affecting us outwardly as suffering and pleasure, evil fortune and good fortune, the great chain of karma. So when we are doing it with the sense that I am the doer, and obviously we cannot fool the divine, should be very clear. We know inside whether we are doing it as a doer, with the sense of doer, or as dedication of that to the divine. Then we get through the consequences. We can't help it because the sense of egoism of the doer is there. But when we have done it, because even there it is the divine who is acting. So this idea that God is doing some things and other things are done by us, this is fallacious. Even there the divine is doing, but through the lower nature, so it's a distorted action. So our will, our egoism is distorting the direct transmission of the truth of God. And that's why many times we'll see that people start a great action. They start as some kind of a divine will has picked them up. But slowly it gets deviated because the egoism comes in. And the classic example is Napoleon. So, and Shubhendu quotes that example. That he was, it was a God-driven action. He saw the arm of God striding through Europe. But a time came when Napoleon said, I am France and France is myself. That's when he thought, I am the doer, I am the great one. He says, Kali slew him and threw him aside. You know how he died an ignoble death, withdrawing from everything. We see in our India also, people often, the story of one of the prime ministers who was close to means who would come to mother, seek her help for Bangladesh. And she has even stayed inside the ashram premises, one of those rare blessings you can imagine. Spending a night inside the ashram, close to the mother's room, across. A room was prepared for her. All this. But a time came when this egoism, particularly in those who are used as instruments by the divine, it can be very dangerous. So this egoism that I am important and I am the one, particularly after the mother's physical withdrawal, and it led to a very painful, literally falling. Because when you do that, then you should be careful that it's all the divine grace, it's all the divine mother's grace, nothing else. I'm not a doer. So that's where one has to be so careful, especially those who become instruments of the divine. Because the same action, the divine will, but the lower nature immediately distorts it. I am the one who is the claimant. I am the one who is, one starts taking all the praise and everything. And then it deviates. So Shubindu is cautioning us. When we are freed by knowledge, the Lord, no longer hidden in our hearts, but manifest as our Supreme Self, takes up our works and uses us as faultless instruments. Nimitta matra, for the helping of the world. So it's no more for myself, for my power, especially wherever thrones are concerned, power position is concerned. The asura is very close and it can immediately sit into the head and say, you are the person who is important, and the whole thing can be very dangerous. Knowledge here in the buddhi, reflected as equality in the temperament, above on a higher plane of consciousness, knowledge as the light of the being, equality as the stuff of the nature. So clarifies, it's not about intellectual knowledge and philosophical knowledge, and yet they serve a purpose. So that we'll read a little bit about scientific, psychological, philosophical knowledge. These two no doubt help us to grow, but only in the beginning, not in the being. So they may help us. Supposing one is into understanding healing process, suddenly you may hit upon a jackpot. Oh, it is the divine who heals. Oh, it is faith that is important. Oh, it is grace that heals. That's a great discovery. You have entered a very wide space through that door. So that's why very often people ask, you know, about healing practice and all. You lose interest because you realize it's not that. It is the grace which is healing. And obviously you can't just say that grace is healing. So you can see the working of the grace through all these means. But at the end it is the grace, in the beginning it is the grace. And if you lose sight of that, if you think the man behind, he is the healer, he is the big man, and the medicines he is using, there are some great discoveries, or the method he is using, whatever be the method, then there is a, you have deviated that original truth. So they can help, but only in the beginning. They enter into the definition of yogic knowledge only when we use them as aids to know the Supreme, the Self, the Divine. Scientific knowledge, when we can get through the veil of processes and phenomenon and see the one reality behind which explains them all. Not this, that, but it, when we can pierce through it, anything we pierce, go to the end, one will discover the Divine. And that way it can help, but not more than that. Psychological knowledge, when we use it to know ourselves and to distinguish the lower from the higher, so that this we may renounce and into that we may grow. So psychological knowledge will make us aware that all this we talk about, processes, ways, and understanding the human mind, is within the limits. Psychological knowledge as it stands today cannot tell us about the soul and about God or the way to reach. It doesn't cover that. So when we understand the difference and we understand the limitations, it can help us open a greater door. Philosophical knowledge, when we turn it as a light upon the essential principles of existence, so as to discover and live in that which is eternal. Ethical knowledge, when by it, having distinguished sin from virtue, we put away the one and rise above the other into the pure innocence of the divine nature. Aesthetic knowledge, when we discover by it the beauty of the divine knowledge of the world. Knowledge of the world, when we see through it the way of the Lord and His creatures. So this way all these knowledge can be a help. Even then they are only aids. The real knowledge is that which is a secret to the mind, of which the mind only gets reflections, but which lives in the spirit. So all these are instruments, mechanism, ways to approach. One starts, let's say, as a healer, and eventually one discovered that there is some much greater reality than healer, healing method. Then one has to abandon it and go there and wait till one discovered the whole thing. Or while doing the works, by abandoning means, instead of getting stuck to that as one has received, one keeps on practicing nishkam karma and equality till the true knowledge comes in and starts pouring. And when the true knowledge comes, perhaps there is no process. The divine can use any process. You pick up an allopathy drug and you give it. And it helps. Because there is one line the divine is using and the person has faith in that. You pick up a homeopathy and give it, helps. All antagonism goes away. Some people are there who come to the ashram dispensary and they say, we want medicine only from here. Unfortunately, people make all kinds of rules. One of the rules is that, you know, now, because money and all this involved, that okay, no, we'll give only to ashramites. I have to explain, look here, it is not about the money. People come with this faith that they are receiving something from Mother and Sri Aurobindo. It's not about money. Money is not everything. And if we take the right attitude, money will come. Everything will come. Because that's how people take it, that it's coming. And that's why it heals. Who knows? So, who knows means that's how it is. It is meant to be. So, the Gita describes that this true knowledge is to be found within us. And page 204, somewhere in the middle, to get this other knowledge. So there is a knowledge which can come from the senses. It is only of the supreme knowledge that this can altogether be said, that it grows within. The knowledge which the intellect of man amasses is gathered laboriously by the senses and the reason from outside. To get this other knowledge, self-existent, intuitive, self-experiencing, self-revealing, we must have conquered and controlled our mind and senses. So take for example Auroville or Ashram. So if you ask outer knowledge, so people will describe what Auroville is, when it was started, when mother conceived. One can go still backward, when mother conceived it, or one can go far back in times and one can go on, then one can describe the department, then one can describe the upheavals, then one can describe the present imbroglio, so and so. But what is really Auroville and Ashram? They are manifestations of the mother's love. Finished. And look at it like that, then the whole perspective changes. Why? Because then in action we should try to embody her consciousness and not go by our mental conceptions. Because it's an expression of her, so we should unite with her and let her flow and work through us. So this is the essential difference. And then finally, most important thing for this knowledge, to arrive at this knowledge, is faith. Because I cannot arrive at something which I don't have faith in. Faith is what keeps the journey going. For example, if I want self-knowledge and the true knowledge, I must have faith that it is possible. I must have faith that there is something like a true intuitive knowledge which can flame up from within and work, show us, guide us. I must have faith. Otherwise, I'll keep on doubting and always act according to my reason or unreason, whatever it be. So this faith is so important. I must also have the faith that if the divine has called me toward this discovery, He will lead me to that. I must have the faith that all of us are fundamentally capable of discovering it. I must have the faith that the path which I am traveling based on whatever I have understood today, it will lead me to that. It will lead me through this journey. Now if this faith is missing, then obviously one doesn't take a step forward. So this is why faith is important. Finally, we must have a faith which no intellectual doubt can be allowed to disturb. Shraddhavan labhate jnanam. The ignorant who has not faith, the soul of doubt, goeth to perdition. Neither this world, nor the supreme world, nor any happiness is for the soul full of doubts. So that's why it is important. Doubt has its utility in lower nature in our seeking. If I see a rope, if I see a snake and I think it is a rope, it is good to doubt. Am I? Before you pick it up. So in lower nature, because knowledge is not, we have not arrived at finality. Therefore, we have to proceed by doubt, because we have not discovered the ultimate truth. But there is something called as an ultimate reality. And when you discover it, and if you are on that path, then it's not doubt, but a seeking. So if I don't understand, for example, then how do I proceed? Not through doubt, but by increasing the aspiration. By growing from knowledge to greater knowledge. This is the process. That's what Sri Aurobindo reveals to us, page 205. Because initially it will all be mixed. Whatever incompleteness there is in the knowledge attained, that means the true knowledge now he's speaking of, it must be got rid of, not by questioning in its roots what has already been realized, but by proceeding to further and more complete realization through a deeper, higher and wider living in the spirit. So supposing I am not able to arrive at that, I have only glimpses. So people begin to doubt the path, they begin to doubt the guru, they begin to doubt the possibility. That's not the way. The way is, what is insincere in me? What is it that has yet kept hold of itself? What is not quite right in my practice? And when one rectifies it, then a greater knowledge comes. That is the path. Whereas doubt means, if I have not had any experience, that means this path is not correct, or it's, the teachings are not right, teachings are not true. Probably I have not tried sincerely enough. So that's what Sri Aurobindo is revealing to us. And what is not yet realized must be prepared for by faith, not by skeptical questioning, which is evident. And people want to sometimes realize the last point. Yoga of the cells and physical transformations. So they take either of the two approaches. Either it doesn't exist, or prematurely they start, I must have the yoga of the physical transformation. But there is a journey. And this journey has to be taken step by step. There is a path. And you can't leap and reach there when we are not even here. So that's how it is. It is not a truth which has to be proved, but a truth which has to be lived inwardly, a greater reality into which we have to grow. So this is how the yoga proceeds. And page 206, first para toward the end, last 7-8 lines, 206. The equality it enjoins does not begin and end in a static condition of the soul useful only for self-liberation. It is always a basis of work. So that's what we are saying, that static condition means it doesn't matter. I'm indifferent. And then Sri Aurobindo gives us example that when we attain to equality through the stoic method. So stoic method is a forced control of the mind to arrive at a static, sage-like calm. Whatever happens, I'll endure. But that's not what Gita is saying, because it's not a sage-like calm by some difficulty. But it is the natural state, a child soul, natural state of inner felicity and peace, which comes by living in the divine. So that mastery becomes natural. It is not something which is done by the power of the mind. Similarly, the philosophic indifference changes into udasinta. Philosophical indifference is, oh, this people are what they are and be indifferent. Then one begins to become cold, aloof. But udasinta is, one looks at the lower nature, laughs at it when people are indulging in it, and also leans down out of love. So it changes the philosophical indifference into a heart of love. Because one sees like children dirtying themselves. And one goes, and 100 times, because there is no more that feeling of superiority, of philosophical superiority. Same with religious acceptance, where we understand, we accept all things as will of God, good and bad. But here it changes into a God-driven action, God's will manifesting in creation. So these are the things which he reveals to us, that how we to take an image from Roman institutions, the Stoic freedom. So he says it is the freedom of the freed man. And the Gita gives us the freedom of the free man. So freed man, from the prison he has been freed. This word Sri Aurobindo uses in Savitri. Freed man from nature or a slave of God. So they are two different. When you are slave of God, you are free. Because you are only obeying the divine command. So he gives this example. The freedom of the Gita is that of the free man, the true freedom of the birth into the higher nature, self-existent in its divinity. Whatever he does and however he lives, the free soul lives in the divine. He is the privileged child of the mansion, Balvat, who cannot err or fall because all he is and does is full of the perfect, the all-blissful, the all-loving, the all-beautiful. The kingdom which he enjoys, Rajyam Samraddham, is a sweet and happy dominion of which it may be said in the pregnant phrase of the Greek thinker, the kingdom is of the child. So, the freedom towards which Gita leads, we'll see the difference. The sage-like calm, you can see a person is by the mind controlling all the reactions, responses. And the other where one becomes a child, naturally happy, full of confidence in the divine grace. That's the sunlit path towards which they are pointing. Similarly, the philosopher, next page he describes, Udasinvat, but as the divine, as seated above, having no need at all in the world, yet he does works always. So, the indifference of the philosopher changes into Udasin. Udasin is he is not interested in doing this or that for its own sake or for some selfish advantage. But for the sake of the divine, he is ready to go anywhere and work anywhere. So it is indeed a position as of one seated above, Udasinvat. Udasin, actually, if you see above, Udasin, that's how it comes. Udasin is not Udasin. That's a different. Udasin is above. Some people assume a very sad countenance, he's become Udasin. No, Udasin is, see the same Ud, they all go from on the same route. So he is above, seated above. But as the divine is seated above, having no need at all in the world, yet he does works always and is present everywhere, supporting, helping, guiding the labor of the creatures. So it's very difficult to understand such a person. Because many people may think, oh, Udasin means why should he be involved with works? In fact, his is a more powerful action all over the world. Precisely because he is not bound or attached to this or that mode of life. This equality is founded upon oneness with all beings. It brings in what is wanting in the philosophic equality, for its soul is the soul of peace, but also it is the soul of love. So without exception, so such a being feels supreme sympathy with all, without exception, aseshana, not only with all that is good and fair and pleases, nothing and no one, however vile, fallen, criminal, repellent in appearance, can be excluded from this universal, this whole soul sympathy and spiritual oneness. That's the true Udasinta, where you are not just maintaining it by a sage-like countenance, oh, all these tuchaprani, mortal creatures, they are, you know, all, they are not worthy of. This is a very dangerous attitude, some people assume. Looking down upon others, condescending others, that they are, you know, lesser mortals, caught up in ignorance, what good are they? This is a very dangerous attitude. But true equality will always make you lean down in compassion and love. And that will not disturb your Udasinta. You will not be interested in the world for its own sake or for any selfishness. Because you are driven by the divine. A divine compassion for the ignorance of the struggling mind, a divine will to pour forth on it all light and power and happiness, there will be indeed for the apparent man. But for the divine soul within him, there will be more, there will be adoration and love. For from all, from the thief and the harlot, very powerful lines, you know, we should read it. For from all, from the thief and the harlot and the outcast, as from the saint and the sage, the beloved looks forth and cries to us, this is I, he who loves me in all beings. What greater word of power for the utmost intensities and profundities of divine and universal love has been uttered by any philosophy or any religion. Just imagine. He makes it very clear. It's not udasinta, doesn't mean this stoic indifference, stoic calm. It's not stoic calm. You're a child. You are not affected by these things. So, again he speaks of the resignation of the religious resignation. But there on page 209 it says, there also a change comes. All result, good or bad, pleasing or unpleasing, fortunate or unfortunate, is accepted as belonging to the master of our actions. So that finally not only are grief and suffering borne, but they are banished. A perfect equality of the emotional mind is established. So basically, religious resignation can be of this type, that what to do? God's will. Anyways, we don't have a choice. But deep inside, one is not happy about it. But the other is, one is receiving it as prasadam, as gift from the master, like Radha's prayer. Accepting it with joy and gladness in the heart. Then one begins to see how behind misfortune there is a blessing. Oh, misfortune, blessed art thou, for thou hast shown me the face of my beloved. So when we practice equality this way, then what happens? We see on next page. Page 210. That all our personal will, instead of being diverted into egoistic satisfaction, turns towards the fulfillment of the divine will. Our will is not banished, it becomes one with the divine will. Therefore, Arjuna is bidden to resist, to fight, to conquer, but to fight without hatred or personal desire or personal enmity or antagonism, since to the liberated soul these feelings are impossible. That's what is the great teaching of the Gita. Not to act for any personal purposes, selfish action, but being impelled by the divine movement within. To act for the Lok Sangraha, impersonally, for the keeping and leading of the peoples on the path to the divine goal, is a rule which rises necessarily from the oneness of the soul with the divine, the universal being, since that is the whole sense and drift of the universal action. Nor does it conflict with our oneness with all beings, even those who present themselves here as opponents and enemies, because here Arjuna is being asked to slay. How can we understand that? So Aurobindo explains, for the divine goal is their goal also, since it is the secret aim of all, even of those whose outward minds, misled by ignorance and egoism, would wander from the path and resist the impulsion. Resistance and defeat are the best outward service that can be done to them. Just imagine. So this is how the Uddhar idea comes. Because they are also, the soul is suffering inside, stifled in a body. So all this one begins to see, for the soul, oneness with all, for the heart, calm, universal love, sympathy, compassion, but for the hands, freedom to work out impersonally the good, not of this or that person only, without regard to or to the detriment of the divine plan, but the purpose of the creation, the progressing welfare and salvation of men, the total good of all existences. So this is where we can stop. We can read this last line. To be made oneself with God above and God in man and God in the world is the sense of liberation and the secret of perfection. This is how this chapter closes. Wonderful chapter. It reconciles knowledge and works on the basis of equality. And how this principle of equality will lead us to knowledge and also more powerful God-driven works in the world. Okay. Thank you. We'll meet next week. Yeah.